Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. I'm your host, Mike Taravella, and I'm with the man, the myth, the legend, Will Coleman. Will, how are you today?
Howdy, Mike. Doing well. Just running the marathon one step at a time and learning. Looking forward to learning from our guest today. Today on the show, we've got Justin Spaulding. He's the president and CEO of Spaulding Group. Justin has been active in real estate since 2009. I'm sure it was a great time to get into real estate. Since 2012, he has completed transactions with a total deal volume of $110 million. It's pretty impressive and has raised over $22 million. He's the author of Sure Thing. And two fun facts, he was an NCAA All-American football player. And we just realized that we just learned that he's doing a podcast soon. So we look forward to checking that out. How's it going, Justin?
It's going well, man. It's going well. Excited for 2021. Although I've been telling people too that we better, all better be careful what we wish for, because it could be worse, right?
Oh, I mean, don't say that.
It could be. So I'm always like, just be careful what you're saying, because it could be worse.
That's, you know, you're the first person to say that. So I appreciate, I mean, it's keeping it real. I mean, with everything going on, like, you got to obviously hope for the best, but kind of like real estate, underwrite the worst, mitigate your risk, and see how you can continue to move forward.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sick of the COVID thing too, but everyone's like, man, hopefully this COVID thing's done with. And I'm like, but just who knows? Every time I'm like, it just could be worse. I think that's kind of set though with everything, but.
New year, new me. That's how I'm living. 2021.
Yeah. What? 9 days. 9 days.
Yeah, it's been the longest 366, I think, all that we've ever had. But to kind of spin the gears on kind of with the 9 days left, what are you, I know we mentioned the podcast, but what are you kind of looking forward? What's like the project that gets you most excited for 2021?
Yeah, you know, I mean, 2020, we had plans of getting up to about 1,500 units. And, you know, early in the year when the whole COVID thing happened and people pretty much stopped showing their properties, and it was just a lot of unknown, and the you know, kind of took a swing. It just made it a little bit higher hurdles. And it's like, does it really make sense? So back in March, I actually started, when that all happened, at some of our properties, we had some larger painting projects come on. So I actually started a painting company in March, and we're actually on pace to do just under $1 million in our first 12 months of operation. So really looking at 2021 to grow that to be $2 million to $2.5 million revenue company. You know, we're working on a deal right now that we got under contract, at the end of, it was early November, end of October that we got under contract. And that's, about 220 units, the portfolio of a couple different assets, up here in the Midwest. That closes mid-January. So we're ready to kind of wrap that up and get that done and, secure that asset and move forward. And then we've got a pipeline of more deals that we're currently underwriting, a lot of them are off market, so we're excited about that. To kind of have the first shot at them, and they're all between, you know, 100 and 450 units. So that's awesome stuff. And we're excited to hopefully, you know, our goal is delayed a little bit, but hopefully the end of 2021, we're between 1,500 and 2,000 units. This purchase that we're working on now, it'll take 700. So that's what we're sitting at. That's what we're looking at, and excited to just get after it right now as we roll into 2021.
And how do you typically finance these deals? Like, I guess in particular, the one you're doing now.
Yeah. So, you know, we've done everything from, we have a pretty good partnership with a regional bank here, Johnson Bank, based in Wisconsin. So it's based out of Wisconsin. So we have a handful of, we have maybe two or three deals that we've got with them, and that's recourse debt. And then we've got a deal with Fannie, and that was an assumption. We've got a CMBS loan that's non-recourse. We've got, you know, this deal coming up. Two parts of it is going to be Freddie. And then there's a third part that's going to be with our regional bank. So it's just kind of all across the board, and just, you know, depending on what we want from flexibility and, you know, proceeds. We do a lot of interest only. Just to give us more cash up front for, you know, we like to pay distributions as we go, while, you know, we also sell a lot of reserve money aside up front so that we can get, you know, our upgrades and all that stuff done. But we like to be able to do some of those upgrades as well from cash flow. So, you know, we have loans that are 10 years interest only. We have, you know, 2 years and 5 years. So we have just kind of across the board. It's just, each product. I'm never someone that like locks into one thing. I try to look at the whole big picture. And then it's like, okay, what works and makes sense here for this asset based on where it is right now, where we want to take it, how long we want to hold it, et cetera.
Yeah. No one puts the assumption.
No one puts Justin in a box. No. Not COVID, not 2020, not a bank.
Dude, Justin, I was not going to go throw up my COVID ball and freaking let my businesses die. Absolutely. I was telling my fiance at the time, my wife now, I'm like, I'll go to jail before my business gets shut down.
Yeah. Oh, we saw a lot of people in Texas take that route as well. Like, there's a famous story about a hair salon. She's like, take me to jail. Like, I'm going, I'm working. Right.
I mean, it's just insane. And so it's not that we're not taking precautions. I mean, we're doing our part and all that stuff, but you know, you look back through time, and whenever there's this hysteria and fear and panic, right, whoever has been able to stay strong through that always comes out the other end way stronger. I mean, you see it over and over and over again. And all I did from, you know, when I was wrapping up college, so when I was a sophomore in 2009 through when I graduated in 2012, all I was doing was reading books on finances, business, investing. So I knew back then, I'm like, okay, when bad stuff happens, I got to be in a position to look to expand and not shrink. And no matter what those circumstances might be. And so that's what I did in this. And, you know, I'm glad that we did.
Yeah. And that's the best part is too, in this whole thing, us as an organization, you mentioned painting, we pretty much bootstrapped a flooring company to work on our internal stuff, 'cause we realized flooring was so expensive to us. So we rolled that out. But I think too, it's all the stuff that we thought about doing, we actually had time to sit down, game plan, and execute. So yep. It wasn't just the day-to-day of, you know, deal flow. It was, how can we generate more revenue? How can we do cost savings? So our virtual leasing went up, our, you know, lead flows for, and even brokers too, right? When everyone sat still, people didn't call brokers, but I had the most conversion of just talking to brokers during that time, because they were sitting at home and by far they didn't want to just be on a Zoom meeting. They're like, oh, I got to call up the client. So yep. It's amazing to see those people who took action during this time reap the rewards already before even 2020 is over, and just riding that momentum going into next year.
Yep. And that's exactly it. 100%.
I'm curious. I've heard a lot of people talk about loan assumptions and you know, obviously people got debt with large yield maintenance prepayment penalties on them and over the last 4 or 5 years. And now assumptions are very popular. How was the assumption process?
Really, it was pretty smooth. You know, that one we were actually able to get, you know, depending on who the debt, who's holding the debt, you might or you may not, and how the original deal was structured, the note and stuff, you may or may not be able to get supplemental debt. So with this one, we actually were able to assume it. I think we had like a 0.5%, you know, fee that we had to pay to assume it. And I think we ended up splitting that with the seller. And then we were able to get a supplemental loan on top of that. So we didn't have to bridge the whole gap. So it was really actually, you know, I work with JLL, the guys out of Chicago, and that team is just awesome. They go above and beyond with everything that they do. And they really made that was May 2019 when we closed that deal. And that they really made that a pretty seamless and just uneventful, due diligence period and closing. They really did a good job, and it wasn't crazy. You know, our interest rate there's a little bit higher, but the property is such a deal. It just cash flows like crazy. You know, we're looking at another deal right now. That's a large property, multi-hundred unit property. And it's got a loan on there. I think that's done in 2024. And the guy's like, should I refi and pay a huge defeasance, or, you know, should I look at selling and pay a huge defeasance? Or should I just wait, or should I try to sell it? And even though, and he recognizes he might not get the full retail value if you were to wait, but he's got other developments that he'd rather move on. He's been in this property since like, you know, mid like 2008, 2009. So he's like, even if I take a little bit of a hit, I'm still going to get more by selling it to someone who's willing to assume and move on to the next project versus having to, you know, take the hit. So we're using that to our advantage. And we're like, you know, I think the loan on that's like a mid fours rate. But we're looking at it as like, okay, it's basically, it's kind of just like a bridge loan. Right. So, but the thing is we'll be like 50% LTV if we end up doing that for the first couple of years, 'cause we can't get a supplemental on it. So now it's like, okay, can I piece together our investment pool that's willing to take you know, smaller return, and but ultimately at the end have a little bit bigger payout there. So it's interesting. But the one that we've done was flawless. It was flawless and pretty easy.
That's good to hear, because most of the time I hear assumptions are pretty brutal. And
I
talk a lot about how it's important to speak with the lender who has the current debt. That way you understand the loan, the assumption process, as well as the possibility of a supplemental loan.
Yep.
And I think too, it's like you said, every deal is, it depends, because there's a lot of people who are like, oh, 4.5 interest rate, that's too high. But that perspective of envisioning it like a bridge loan, that's like a great paradigm into it, because 4.5 was a great rate back then, but obviously with 2020 and everything changing. But I think it's also too, it's you're hearing the investor's problem of, do I take the fast nickel or do I wait for the slow dime? And just being able to be there to solve those problems. And that, I think between those two, that paradigm and that ability to solve that problem, that's how you get unlock more deal flow, right?
Yeah.
I think instead of calling the brokers, just like everyone else, going on LoopNet, like other people, like you're taking a creative approach by diving so deep in your market that you have access to a whole new pool of deals that not many people have.
Yep. Yeah. And that's the thing is, I'm never, so you just brought up like, well, some people just look at interest rate and they'll be like, oh, no way, I'm not assuming that, or I'm not doing the deal. And I, once again, going back to what I said before, I try to look at the whole picture, no matter what the situation is. I'm never a guy that just looks at cap rate. I'm never a guy that just looks at price per unit. I'm never a guy that just looks at one thing. I try to literally take all of it and put it all together, versus just because you're going to box yourself in, like, you know, going back to that thing, you're going to box yourself in where it's just like your options are so limited, when really there's still really good deals out there. But it's like, what's your plan for it? You know, how can you position it? And there's more that you always got to look at more than just one or two factors. You got to look at the whole picture.
And what are you looking for now in a deal? Like, are you looking at just a good deal, or are there certain metrics you look for in cash on cash? Like, how do you determine a good deal in today's market?
I mean, we'll always obviously give more credit to something that has scale. So scale is something that I've just become more and more of a fan of, especially since we closed the 200 unit that we closed, you know, at the end of November last year. I mean, it just, to have 200 units on one property, it really pays huge dividends. And just, you know, I'll always give a little bit more credit there. You know, we're starting to look at stuff that, you know, does not need as much heavy lifting. Cause it's like, by, you know, some of the numbers that we're seeing on these properties that still really need heavy lifting, versus paying a little bit more to have something that is a lot better taken care of and not as much deferred maintenance and all that stuff. It is seeming to make more sense. So like this deal that we're closing mid-January, there's really like no deferred maintenance. I mean, they've taken really good care of it. There's not much CapEx to do. So we're starting to look at more deals like that and be open to that. Whereas like 4 years ago, I mean, I was only looking at stuff that needed $15,000 to $20,000 per unit put into it.
I think that's understanding where we are in the market cycle too, of taking that huge risk where you have to put 10 grand in a door plus like return on effort, right? Do I want to keep doing these heavy projects, or do I want to take a little bit less risk going through it and just really operating? Because then you, especially too, with the 200 units, you can dial in operations and create a ton of value, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people obviously want to raise rents, but a lot of people don't understand like the other income aspects or reducing bloated costs that can dial in. We saved $1 million in one of our properties. We took over a year by not doing a billboard or having 10 different office subscriptions. And so I think when you have that scale, you can make even 10x, 100x impact by just dialing in those operations pieces.
Yep. Well, like in Wisconsin, what we started doing about a year and a half ago was, instead of taking a deposit for dogs, like we'll do a $200 upfront fee and then it's a monthly fee. And so that $200 a month fee, that's adding to our NOI versus, you know, being a deposit that, yeah, we'll probably end up keeping later down the road, but we're getting to show it now as income. So, I mean, there's things like that that have really, you know, we've been able to take advantage of a lot of things like that just by being able to pay attention to our business and say, hey, what options do we have here from other forms of income? You know, looking at like reserved parking spots and, you know, charging, you know, taking over properties that have storage units in the basement, but there's a zero charge for it right now. Well, you can easily get an extra $5, $10, $15, $20 a month, depending where you're at, or more for those. So we start doing that, and it just adds up, and it's crazy. You take a 5.75 or a 5.5 or a 6% cap rate to those numbers, and you know, you have a 200 unit property, and it starts to, it really, really adds up.
Especially when you get that tired owner who doesn't think of it, and they're like, this is good enough, right? Yep. Like, it makes enough versus fresh eyes, fresh perspective come in. And even too, like, light paint on the exteriors can change, revolutionize the entire curb appeal, the branding on signs. It's like, when we take over those things, those little things add up, add the value on the market, but then there's some incremental fees, but that just makes your investors happy, your residents happy. And we've seen that with our net promoter scores that we do every month with our investors.
Yeah.
It's trending up.
Yeah. And going back to the return on effort, right? I mean, that's one of our biggest issues right now is, you know, wrap up a value add that we got going. It's a 47 unit and then the 199 unit. I mean, it's like, it's a ton of work just to stay on top of all that stuff, to keep it moving so that you don't have a freaking unit vacant and offline for 300 days. That's happened here. I'm not going to admit it. Like, we've had units that have been off market. I'm like, why the hell is this market? Like, I'll go through our vacancy, the 300 days, 250 days, 203 days. I'm like, what is going on here? Right. But it's just a part of it. And you start to look at all that, and then you start to see the escalating prices in those value add properties. And it's like, yeah. So
Do you manage your properties, or do you have third party?
Yeah, so we do. We don't do any third party, but we do manage all of our stuff. So our investor dollars that we raise, and then, you know, my money, my family's money, all that stuff. We put into projects, and we manage them all. So in house.
And how's that been? So we self manage as well, and it has its pros and cons, right? That you have a significant amount of control. You truly have your hands on the project and who's running it. But then if you want to scale, buy 1,000 units, then all of a sudden you've got to create a whole management company for taking on new units. How's it been for you?
Yeah, it's gone well for us. I mean, that was a big thing for me, is I always, you know, we got to build the infrastructure to be able to support what we're doing here. And it's got to be substantial infrastructure if you want to do it right. And a lot of people don't realize that. And so when I first started, I was buying deals that we were buying them at such a price that it's like, it doesn't matter who was running them. Could have been, you know, just a complete idiot running them. You're still going to make it. And so for me, it was like, okay, the assets got to come first, because I need the assets and I need to get a track record. I need to get money that way it enables me to build this infrastructure. So I was just buying assets and just like, I would do one interview with someone. Yep, you're hired. Let's roll. And like, that's like 16 employees, and like the people that we had around, like, just weren't cutting it. I mean, just were not cutting it. Right. And we were succeeding, right. We had a lot of success just because, like, once again, how we bought them and whatever. So then we got to the point where, we had enough properties and in our management fees and all that stuff to be able to hire a chief operating officer. So I hired CJ, and she came from a large company up in Madison. And so she kind of oversees all of our management and our managers and the hiring and all that. And we're getting to the point, like, we need to hire like a regional manager. And so there's different, and like a project manager. And so it's just like coming up with the resource. And that's part of the reason I started the painting company too, because I don't personally need the money from the painting company, but if it can create us more resources, and then we can almost like share some of those resources between the painting company and like a project manager, for example. We might be able to share a project manager that's in the painting company and in the properties. Right. So it's just finding dollars and resources to be able to build the infrastructure. And you look at, you know, Blackstone and KKR and all those companies. I mean, that's what it's all about, is the people and the infrastructure that you have to then be able to handle and run the assets the way that you want to run them. And ultimately that's where you're going to get your value as an owner, is the value of the asset increasing. Right. So, that's kind of my mindset with that. But yeah, I'd be interested to hear, you know, a big thing with us has been turnover, you know, with managers and maintenance tech specifically. So do you guys see that as well? Or?
Oh yeah. I think the biggest thing too is, I think we've seen a lot of turnover, but I think too, it's as you scale, you have more ability to see pain points sooner. Right. So when, like, we'll see a property manager and I can just tell how the numbers are, because I'm mainly the acquisitions and asset management. So right when, like, delinquencies start to tick and, like, we have a, like a pull stock every week that we send out just to kind of see what's going on at the property level. I can generally tell the property managers out in the next month or two, because literally our team is so dialed in, becoming more and more dialed in on the numbers. When they let the gas off, they're not asking questions. I know they're gone. So I think because we've just hired an HR person and it's changed the game for our organization. But I think too, kind of your point, phase one, it's get as many units to be able to hire that person. And you've done so well that not many people who have properties can understand that the numbers can lie and the property can carry itself just on sheer location. We've had a couple of those properties where I'm like, oh, it's looking good. And then the property management team's like, no, it's not. And so it's been crazy to see. And then as you grow, right, you've entered a new phase of hiring those executive levels to kind of oversee and scale up and get those A players in the right seats. So yeah, I think you're just making sure you have those, you know, the culture fits, obviously, but more importantly, kind of what you need to execute, because the more dialed in on that, you scale quicker and you can identify B and C players much faster.
Yeah. How many units do you guys have, and how many in the management, how many staff in the management company?
So we just sold one of our properties. So we were at 1600, but we're down to 1400. And we're approximately 55 employees. Mm-hmm. So yeah, our biggest, like you said, the maintenance is the hardest part, but also too, we're based in Knoxville, and then we're in Lexington and Louisville. So it's, you know, as you go further and further away from that central base, it's implementing those culture pieces as well to kind of expand is the hardest piece. And it's and that's top down.
Yeah. And what we're really trying to focus on right now is getting like basically so that everything's like a checklist, and it's like hopefully a 15-page thing. And it's like, hey, here's the different silos of the company and the processes. Here's the checklist. Anything that needs a more detailed how to, we can create another sheet or whatever. But we just are really trying to get to the point where we're really documented there. And so then we're just basically meeting with them monthly and just pounding in our playbook, because I look at it, you know, being a football player, I look at it, it's like, you know, and this is what I'm trying to implement. You know, when we get to fall camp as a football player, like you see the plays on the screen, right? And you see them drawn out. So you know that this post pattern is like 15 yards and then, you know, you're cutting in towards the middle. But what you don't see is all the things that the veteran guys know until you get out on the field, right? And so that's what I'm telling our team and our leaders. I'm like, we need to have a high level thing that this is our playbook, and it doesn't need to be so detailed that no one wants to look through it, right? We just like the how-to, or not the how-to, but the things that need to be done and not the how-to. And the how-to, we're going to have to learn in the field. And that's where we're going to show them that, okay, well, this is six steps, you know, vertically, you stem the guy, you take a 6-inch step this way, and then you cut towards the post, right? And that's all got to be learned in the field and from repetition and just pounding it in. And so with these documents that we're trying to, in this infrastructure and these documents that we're trying to make, this playbook, I'm trying to not be too detailed in it, but it's just that structure. These are the things that need to be done, right? Like a checkbox, check, check, check. And then when you get to things like, well, how do I do that? Now that's things that we got to coach on in these monthly meetings and the manager meetings and all that stuff. And so we're really trying to get to that point so that everyone's speaking the same language. And so that not all of our managers are calling our chief operating officer or regional manager for every little thing, right? So that they can take some ownership in it. And so that's where we're trying to get to now, because you know, I think we're all going through some of those same pain points and you know, yeah.
Well, cause as you build the team, right, like how you run the offense might be a little bit different than someone else's, but as long as you have the same language. And even I worked with a lot of startups and like working with like Dan Gilbert and stuff, and just seeing how there be no process and everyone's like, I have no idea what's happening. And I'm like, that's the most terrifying thing. So even like with our side of the business, we do like Zooms, or they used to be Looms, but we record a Zoom on how we do it. We download it all in one spot so that everyone can see how we run these reports and what to look for and why. Even Will on the mortgage brokerage side is developing his check. I told him to read eMyth, and then he's like, Mike, I got Asana up. I'm doing all these checklists too. So that's like the fun part I geek out on, of just how many days can the business run without you before they need to like get a hold of you? Because the type A person, it's a test when they can take a nap in the middle of the day and say no to everything. Yeah. Not just to do more and more and more.
And that's the same stuff I've told. Last night I had the conversation at 7 p.m. with our chief operating officer about that stuff. I'm like, you got to get to the point where you just got to like not pick up your phone at some point, and you got to be able to. People got to be, because like three of us can't swim with 85 employees on our back, right? And so you got to be able to figure that out. And you know, and it's the same thing. I mean, you look at McDonald's, right? And I'm assuming there's a decent little turnover there at each store and stuff, but they have processes and standards, right? And that's how these places can run. And but you know, that being said too, I think we're also trying to be better from the standpoint of retaining employees just by small little things that we do inside our company with how we communicate with people and, you know, the camaraderie and, you know, all that stuff. But that was something that I really struggled with before I could focus on the people. When I was just getting assets, when I was just hiring people, like I couldn't go through enough people to make sure they had the core values first. Cause I'd rather have people that have our core values that might not have the capacity to do the job right away, but they could learn it just because they have the same core values. It's also easier to talk to those people and have a tough conversation with people that have the same core values as you. For a while, there were people around here, I couldn't have tough conversations. I couldn't be myself because I knew if I was, they'd be gone. They'd be out of here.
Right. Yeah.
Now that we're hiring around core values, I can be pretty rough on some of the people around here, but they know they're not taking it personal. Like they know it's just for like to get them better. They know it's constructive criticism. So that's also helped. And I think we'll continue to help kind of going forward when it comes to, you know, retaining and building the company.
Yeah. I think the kind of the epiphany I had in eMyth was they use the McDonald's example perfectly, but building a system that is so good and is so black and white and easy to understand, and that you can take even not good people and put them into the system and the system will still run well.
Yep.
And then if you build a system that is that easy to follow, that you can reproduce even with not high quality people, and then you put high quality people in those positions, then that's when the, you know, growth really starts happening, and you want to build a strong system first and then add strong people to it.
Yeah. And I've never read that book, so I've heard of it. I should grab it though, cause you guys have mentioned it now.
I'm like the worst system person in the world. I'm just like, just get it done. I don't care.
That's how I am too. At the heart.
After I read that book, I was like, this is going to make my life so much easier.
I'm that way too, but I know that we need it. Like, and so now I'm like, these last couple of weeks, I've really put my foot down and like going forward. Like, okay, we need these things, and we need to build on them and hold people accountable this way.
Yeah, like a perfect example is we were just sent a $23 million deal. So we broker out loans. So we were going to size this up and take us to Fannie. And immediately I'm like, oh, this is a huge deal. Like, I've got to take it. You know, I'm going to do everything because now I run the ship. And I thought, I was like, no, this is a perfect example or opportunity to pass this along to the team and test out the system at a high level that we built, rather than saying, because this is an important deal, I have to do everything. So that was like a huge epiphany for me.
Yep.
And I always laugh because even too, like when you onboard someone, I think that's the hardest part is the team members who've been there very long, when someone else onboards that's new, there's always that knowledge gap that people are like, oh, they don't get it. And I'm like, well, no, we don't. They don't know, right? When you're kind of like a newborn that's like, I have no idea what's happening, but everything's happening. And property management, it's not like, oh, you get a 90-day training period where, you know, nothing bad happens. It's like day one, you can have like a basement flood,
fire
the day before Christmas. Like anything can happen, right? And it's people's livelihoods and like their homes that they care about. So it's not like property management's like, all right, we'll ease you in. It's like, you're going to get probably thrown into the fire, and it's just making sure, you know, having those checklists and those systems. That's because like you said, like if you're not there, or your COO is not there, or your team isn't there, they're going to have to figure it out one way or another. So just making sure they can see the things you see and teaching that down. And that culture piece will come too, because it's like you said, it's the everyday. It's not like a bonus at the end of the year or a party. It's how you interact every single day, and those accumulation. That's how the culture is built top down.
For sure.
So we're coming to the end of the year. 2021 is going to be an interesting one in real estate. Absolutely. What are your thoughts on kind of what the multifamily market looks like over the next 6 to 12 months?
I try to look at things so much longer than that. You know, the next 6 to 12 months, I mean, what's really interesting right now is like what's going to happen when, you know, the eviction moratoriums and stuff are lifted. You know, I mean, I think that there's some people that, you know, sometimes we're made out to be bad people, I think, as property owners and stuff like that. But I'm, you know, like ourselves, and I'm sure you guys as well, we've worked with people that legitimately have shown that they've been affected. Like, we're working with those people that seek us out and reach out to us and communicate with us. And so what's going to be interesting, though, is, I mean, there's going to be a lot of people. There's also a lot of people that played the system and played the game, right? And that are always playing late or whatever, and they really use this to their advantage. What's going to happen to all them? You know, I don't know. Odds are that they probably already spent all the stimulus money they received, and there's probably going to be a ton of evictions. So I think, you know, that whole thing playing itself out is going to be interesting. I think what's going to be interesting as well is, you know, I don't know if you guys paid attention, but the amount of like the cost of like plywood and materials like that, like just lumber. I mean, all of that stuff has gone up substantially over the last, you know, 12 months. So that's interesting from a standpoint of, okay, now on top of that, Democrats, you know, Joe Biden being in office, and, you know, there's a lot of different variables there, but between the prices already going up, depending on how much power Democrats get, you know, there could be more regulations that makes all that stuff more expensive to build new. Well, then what's, you know, the things that are already held then and already built, they're also going to rise in price. And so sometimes like right now, there's a lot of people saying, yeah, but you know, I'm looking to, 100 single family homes that I know about a half hour away from me. And he sent me a picture with all of his tax bills. I said, dude, my 100 unit, I sent him a picture of one of our 100 units. He said, I'm trying to sell these. He's like, I just can't make sense of any deal that's out there. I'm like, there's still deals out there. I'm like, there's still deals out there. You got to make the jump to multifamily. Because in my opinion, I really think it's only going to get more expensive. You know, the difference between now and, you know, 2008, there was so much excess supply. And really, is there excess supply right now? I mean, in some markets, potentially. But even like Houston, for a while, they were worried in Houston that they overbuilt 2 or 3 years ago. And Houston, as far as I don't pay super close attention to that market, but as far as the numbers that I have seen from a high level, like, that's a hot market still. I again don't want to be the person that. So then at the same time, like, I don't want to over leverage as well. Right. So that's another thing that going forward that I'm going to be aware of is I won't refinance to the hilt. Meaning like if we had a lot of value, I'm never someone that's refinancing to the max, 80% again, even if it's non-recourse, I would rather just sell the building at that point. So that's another thing that we'll keep doing going forward. But yeah, I think 2021, even with, you know, numbers, delinquency numbers perhaps being higher for the past 12 months and all that stuff, I still think, you know, price per units and overall asset prices are still going to increase. That's my guess and gut feeling.
Yep. Plus, like you said, the demand has increased and private equity from, like you said, 08, private equity wasn't even touching multifamily. And now I feel like every 3 days there's a new fund group coming in. Yep. I mean, even we've lost out on a 50 unit because institutional groups are coming in our markets. And yep. It's like, it used to be like 200 units, 150 units. Yep. Now it's down to 50. So yep. I agree that it'll be hotter. But like you said, even with the risk going up, prices will continue to rise because there's just so much demand because those larger groups have to beat inflation versus we have investor returns we have to hit.
And I continue to look at like how bad a property can do with the debt terms and everything that we have, and we still make it. And it's like, if I can go back to like 1995 rents and still be making it, like, you know, in vacancies that are 12%, like 15%, I mean, you know, I mean, why would you not do the deal? You know, so there are deals now, like we wouldn't have missed 3 years ago, but this deal that we're doing right now, we're about 70% LTV. So, you know, and that's something that we wouldn't have done, you know, on a purchase right out of the gates, even though we still have room for rents to go up and all that stuff, we're being a little bit more conservative there with how much debt we're taking on. And we're still hitting our numbers we need to be as far as returns and all that. But, so it's just kind of being aware of all that and, you know, never sell, you know, going back to what you said before, on how can I look at every property that I already own with a fresh set of eyes as well to see where else I can bring income in or cut expenses. You know, what we talked about before, the systems, the people, I think those are going to be super important as we continue to go forward. I think, you know, it's really interesting. Just, this is a people thing. it's really interesting, and I'd be interested to hear what you guys say about this. Whenever we interview someone that supposedly has 5 to 10 years of experience, they, you know, the five, yeah, I got five, and then their resume shows out, and like we call the people, yeah, they worked here, and like, I'm like, they'll be 3 months in. I'm like, how the heck did you have 5 to 10 years, or, you know, whatever, like if this person's five and that, how did you have 5 years experience and how did you have 10 years experience? What were you doing? But then you look around, that's why there's so much opportunity, right? Because there's a lot of people that are in this business that really don't know what they're doing from a business standpoint, but they were able to make it through just because they were in a good location. They were able to hold on long enough, right?
And the margin of error was so big, like you can survive. Like even look right. at mobile home parks, you know, people are like 20 cash on cash and we're not touching it. And it's like, okay, well, the guy who's going to look for 15 is going to buy it. Like it's
right.
that margin of error is just shrunk.
Yep. 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 So I think like stuff like that's going to be important, you know, into 2021 and 2022, 2023. I pay attention to the Bulio brothers. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. They're out of Chicago. They're two economists. They've got some really good stuff. ITR Economics, I think, is the name of their company. But I follow a lot of their stuff, and they're not like biased. I mean, they just kind of present the information and give thoughts. And if they're wrong, they can kind of admit, hey, when we gave this presentation in 2018, this thing has proven to be wrong, right? And so it's kind of cool to see, to get that perspective. And a lot of it's very practical advice to give business owners and stuff like that. And they're predicting like, you know, a small downturn in 2024, 2025, nothing like crazy, nothing like what 08, 09 was. But then they're expecting like 2029, 2030 in the 2030s to be like the Great Depression of what it was in the early 1900s. So I follow a lot of that stuff. And just once again, you know, reinvesting back into your business and infrastructure, not just people, but also like the software and stuff, right? And technology. Not stripping all the cash out of your business, I think is a big thing, especially as we go forward now as well. So,
well, as you invest down, right, you have those residents, like even in us, it's like we invested, you know, we had toilet paper we gave out to our residents and like, hey, during these crappy times, RAM Property Management's here for you. And that's kind of like a top-down culture piece of, well, we're thinking of our residents first and helping them. And just like you said, all the systems, it's how do we make our residents' lives easier? Because then we'll have less turnover, which means less renovations, which means more money. And so yep. it's just like all those dominoes that you hit, and it's like, and everything's going up. So if you do all yep. those things, everyone, it's a win, 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 win.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, the programs and grants are out there, whether they're nationally or locally or whatever, but I mean, we're out there helping our tenants over the last 6-7 months, like making them aware, getting them the paperwork. Like basically we're doing everything we can because we can't fill out a lot of paperwork for them. They have to be the person that submits and all that stuff. And which, by the way, is amazing when you say, hey, here's like basically $5,000 free if you just fill this paperwork out and send it to the government. It's amazing how many people still won't even fill it out or get back to you. But doing things like that, what you guys just said with, you know, the toilet paper, I mean, you know, that's important stuff. And it all of that, all of those small details will for sure add up. They do.
Absolutely. Cool. So before we go to our investor pro tip, let's take a moment to hear from our sponsors.
Is your money working as hard as you are? At RAM Partners, we partner with hardworking investors who are seeking true passive income through multifamily real estate. Partnering with RAM means transparent communication with our webinars, monthly statements, and newsletters. For more information, visit rampartners.com to register for our investor portal and to set up a call with our team. And we're back. So Justin, a lot of great knowledge and tips and everything. Great talking to you. But what is your one investor pro tip for our listeners that they can take into 2021?
I'll go back to what I kind of mentioned before is when you're looking at all these deals, try to look at it from both sides of the coin, many different angles as possible to see how it could or might not be a fit. Try to get away from like just looking at just the cap rate or just the price per unit, try to find what the actual story is there in the financials and all that stuff. And then the second one is like, you know, look at the areas that you can invest back into your business. And from when I talk in business, I'm not just talking the actual property. I'm talking about if you're operator, or even if some people are listening that aren't in real estate yet that have other businesses, where can you reinvest that capital and deploy that into your company to become more profitable later down the line because of those investments. Those would be my two challenges or tips.
Perfect. I love it. And if anyone did have any questions for you, wanted to reach out, or if they want to learn more about your future podcast, what would be the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So you can go to YouTube, my YouTube channel. Just search me, Justin Spaulding, S-P-A-U-L-D-I-N-G is my last name. Search it on YouTube. You can find me on Instagram. Instagram, I'm always posting stories and what's going on every single day. So those are two good places to start. And then you can always DM me or message me on there. And I'm always replying and all that stuff.
Justin puts out a lot of great content. And I know early in my career, he was super helpful. Just in those dog days, that 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. shift, it was like, all right, cool. This is the other side of it. So big piece. But thank you so much, Justin, for being on. Please reach out to Justin. He's a huge resource and here to help. Subscribe to his podcast when it comes out or else. And if you have any questions for us, please reach out to us at info@randsiri.com. Until then, we'll see you next week.